evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Mary Lorson. Lorson is an accomplished singer, musician, and songwriter. During most of the 1990s, she was lead singer and rhythm guitarist for the alternative rock group Matter Rose. She's currently lead singer, composer, and lead musician for the art rock group St. Lo. Mary Lorson and St. Lo's most recent CD is called Realistic, and it's on the Cooking Vinyl label. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I always ask musicians this. How did your road begin as a musician? Did it start in childhood?
It did start in childhood, yeah. And it was a very dreamy, really wonderful start. I just kind of stumbled into it and started to play piano really young, by ear, and I was just writing about this recently. I was trying to put together when I started picking things out on piano. So, yeah, I just started loving to play and sing.
Was this encouraged by your parents, or did you say, Mommy, I want to study piano? How did that happen?
Oh, it was very much encouraged. My dad's a pianist, actually, and he wasn't around when I started to play because my parents separated when I was very young. But my mom saw pretty early that was something I'd kind of gotten from him, and she was very encouraging. The only problem was that I preferred to play by ear than to learn conventional notation. And so when I was young, I was a terrible student, and now I really regret that.
A lot of musicians have told me that. That's mm-hmm. that independence, it seems, in musicians.
I'm not sure. I think it was a stubbornness, and I think maybe there was just enough of a lapse of time between when I developed the interest and when they actually started to try to teach me that I had learned pieces that were kind of really beyond my ability, just like a monkey. I just have an ear, and like a monkey, I learned to play things. So then when they tried to teach me how to read music, the stuff that the pieces were so simple that I was bored, and I was cocky enough to think that I didn't need it, and now I really sorely wish I had learned.
Yeah. How did you start to perform publicly, your first foray into public performing? Did you hook up with some other bands, or did you present yourself as a solo?
I think the very first public performances I did were in this singing group. I went to an alternative elementary school in Irvington, New York for 5th and 6th grade, and it was this really great arts thing. It was like an open classroom, and you had a lot of free time. So I played the piano when I was in this singing group, and it was called Special Five. And they would take us around, and we performed in nursing homes, and other schools and stuff like that. And so I really liked that. And I think my earliest performing memory is performing in a nursing home at a Christmas time, and there being elderly people crying and touching us, and just feeling very loved by them, and it definitely meant something.
Uh-huh. And what were you performing? What kind of a group was it?
Well, it was they did popular numbers, so we did some Carpenters songs, and we did I'm sure we did I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing. We did some stuff from Hair. I think we did Good Morning Starshine.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure if that's the title of it, but the one that has that.
I think it is.
And we did what else? It was definitely like those sweet, smooth pop hits, uh-huh. Of the late 60s.
That's great. I love it.
Great stuff.
Now, do I understand correctly that you left Matter Rose after 10 years with them because you started wanting to write and you found your own voice?
It wasn't really
leaving. How did that happen?
It wasn't really leaving.
Okay, talk about it.
We had been going for a long time. We had this very intense flush where our first three records got made. And then we were finding there was longer and longer stretches of time between tours because we lost our major label deal and our manager all within about 2 months of each other. Our manager kind of left the ship when the label dropped us after our third record with Atlantic. And so I had been there had been a lot of free time, and I'd been collecting songs that weren't right for Matter Rose. I would, there were a few songs I'd bring to the band, and they'd realize it wasn't really right for what we did. And I set them aside and met Mike Stark here, and I met at the time Stahl Queso played bass initially, and Zahn Marshburn played drums. These are Mike and Zahn had Wingnut going, and I just was in love with them and the way they all played. And so I put St. Lo together while Matter Rose was still going on, actually. And they weren't meant to be mutually exclusive. It was just actually, I think that everybody, a lot of us had side projects going on in Matter Rose because it had once been a full-time thing and then became less of one.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then when Matter Rose, we just realized that we couldn't keep it going because we were living far away from each other, and we just kind of thought the time seemed right to put it down. But it wasn't like a I'm leaving kind of thing.
Okay, because I understood
mutual.
From your biography that you decided that you wanted to start writing your own stuff.
And
form whatever would become your own voice with new musicians. But
which is definitely, that's true too. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what prompted you to start writing?
Well, it was funny. I think that was a long time coming. I think I tried writing for a very long time. I think I had lots of friends in bands when I was in my 20s, and I did start writing then, but frankly, the first 5 years of songs were not that good. There might have been one or two good ones, or lots of songs that had good parts, but then other parts that just weren't happening. A lot of these songs, they showed some, when I look back now, I'd say shows promise, but just weren't happening. But I didn't give up on it, and then I met Billy, who had really hit his own. He'd reached
who
his own.
Billy?
Billy Cote, who's my, we're married now, and we met when we started Matter Rose. He had the whole concept for the band. He'd written a bunch of songs, and he was looking for a female singer. I was doing my own band at the time, and I had done a demo, and I met Billy, and people just responded really well to our collaboration, and I really liked his songwriting. He just had this great way of being melodic and concise, and so I learned a lot about songwriting from him, even though our styles are very different. He told me a lot about his process, which I thought was interesting. And just over time and repetition and lots of failures, came into my own as a songwriter later, much later.
And what were some of the emotions that were prompting you to write, too? Was it emotions? Was it politics? What kind of songs were you writing?
Oh, lots of them.
What was dying to get out?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when I first started writing songs, I was listening to a lot of, like, Elvis Costello and The Clash and The Pretenders, and so there was a lot of vehemence and this forceful, very clear-eyed commentary on the world and stuff like that. But I won't say that I wasn't also affected by, like, Joni Mitchell and people who were really looking at themselves psychologically and emotionally and stuff like that. I mean, there's so much great music when I was growing up, and I'm so old now that I've absorbed so much, you know, music that
exactly.
It's hard to say, you know, what had predominance over what else. But I think that's a good question. I'm not sure what it is. I think you're maybe just born with the inclination, or you're not.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't start out like a lot of young women do, writing confessional poetry, for instance.
No.
And then it segued into songwriting.
No, I think when I started, I've always kind of struggled with this balance thing. Like, I love female music. I love being a woman. I love all that stuff. But I also really have a blast doing rock and roll, or being, you know, being kind of
so you want to be Melissa
boisterous.
Do you want to be Melissa Etheridge?
She's
like a rocker woman
person.
Who writes really interesting songs, I think, yeah.
Yeah. No, she seems like a very happy person, and she seems to be very true to herself, and that's true, too. I'm not really sure who my one model would be. One thing I've always kind of strived for in my music is to try to find a way to integrate a lot of really different influences, and That's the challenge I set for myself, and that's what keeps it interesting.
I sense that you are influenced perhaps by Suzanne Vega. You sound a little bit like Suzanne Vega to me.
I really liked her first couple of records. I could say that, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It's simple and concise, and, you know.
She had a great straightforward way of putting a thought, definitely.
Yeah. It, when you first would hear it, like I did with your music, it sounded somewhat flat almost, but then you start hearing what's going on beneath that, and the flatness lets you in, I think.
Yeah.
And which brings me to the fact that I would love to play a cut from your CD Realistic, and I want to play the cut Ties That Bind.
Okay. Roman, Roman, I told you to turn out. There's nothing you miss. I'm not changing my mind. I don't care about everyone else. You alone can make heaven of hell. Woman. Woman.
So that's a fascinating song. Mm-hmm. When I first heard it, I thought it could be almost a melancholic love song to a real lover. But mm-hmm. I realize it's for your son.
Yeah.
Talk to me about where that song came from. It seems very melancholic.
Oh, it is very melancholic. When Roman was 14 months old, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I was, you know, of course you're floored and you're freaked out and all that stuff. And you know, it was this, when I think about the moment when I received the diagnosis, and Billy was by my side, so we received it. It was kind of like you could hear a door slamming, you know, in your head saying, thus ending the happiest year of your life, because we had this beautiful little kid and things were good. So I kind of wrote this song, and it's funny because my friend from high school wrote to me about this. What do you mean by that? What are you saying? And I guess I was projecting into the future. I was wanting so badly to reach the point in his life when I'd be saying, turn out the light. You know, I wanted to know there was a future for us. I wanted, you know, I just...
Normalcy, right?
Yeah, I was just hoping that I would be yelling at him about turning off the light and, you know, arguing with me. Because back then he was basically pre-verbal. I mean, he had just learned to walk and he was so little. So basically I think a lot of it has to do with just, you know, how much sentiment and tenderness you have for your kid and how little control you have over what they experience in their lives and what you hope, you know. You hope to give them the best, you know. Mm-hmm. If you can't fix it, you'll paint it shiny and bright. You know, it was basically my way of saying we're going to do our best.
Yeah.
For you.
Did being diagnosed with breast cancer change your life considerably?
Yeah. It did, and then I had a recurrence last year, so twice now. It's definitely changed my life. In some ways, although I have to tell you, I wasn't really someone who needed to be reminded that life was precious. So you hear people who say, oh, well, it taught me, you know, to appreciate every day. I really was. I already did that. Uh-huh. You know, I did. I love life, and I've been through serious health stuff when I was younger, too. So I think very early on I learned that life is precious and everything is really meaningful, and there's nothing really that you should write off.
Yeah. So you actually didn't need the reminder.
I really didn't. But, you know, you do it, you know, you deal with what comes.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about the fact that you've been the lead singer for quite a number of groups and you've done backup. Have you ever thought about going totally solo? Just Mary Lorson without the tag?
Nah. Nah.
Really?
Not interested.
Well, why is that?
Because I'm not really that good, and I just
what
have
do you mean
really
you're
good,
not really that
I
good?
I have really good taste in musicians, and I have a lot of really talented friends. And when you collaborate with other people, they bring out all these different sides to you. So, I mean, like, I was the luckiest thing that ever happened was meeting Billy Cote, because I was slugging along, and I have a nice enough voice, and back then I barely knew how to use it. Now I'm better singer, but I could barely play guitar, and I met this person who had written these songs, and it was really kind of a kismet, because there was just a nice natural chemistry between what we did, and so much happened for us both, and then, you know, of course, he became my partner in life, so it was a really lucky thing. And then I think about meeting the Wingnut guys, and how Mike Stark in particular, I was writing a certain kind of song that was quite different, and he just heard it and knew how to respond. He made those songs so much more deep and beautiful. And that's just the way I feel about it. I mean, I work with everybody who's great in this town I've played with, and I just
yes,
everybody's
have.
Precious, you know. Mm-hmm. Brian Dudla, Matt Morano, Walt Lawrence is my favorite bass player on this earth, you know what I mean? It's like, It's not that special solo, whereas when you have great musicians responding and putting depth in, that's what I find really satisfying. So actually, Steve Galnick just joined St. Lo as a rhythm guitar player and a backup singer, in addition to Jen Middaugh, who's still doing backups. And that's going to be fun, too, because I'm writing a different kind of song now for this next batch, and Steve's an amazing guitar player. He's going to bring in this steady acoustic rhythm thing, so when I'm on piano or playing electric, he can... We'll have that texture and the male voice.
Steve is really good. I love his guitar, yeah.
Oh, I love
him. He was a guest on the show last year, yeah.
He's just wonderful. Mm-hmm. So it's just really great. He and I have been having fun goofing around doing X songs together, you know, with the male and female thing. And so I love the idea of having the texture of a male voice. That's something I never really had steadily before. So I think, you know, you're only as good as the people who play with you.
Yeah. But a lot of women go solo, and they do have their musicians that travel with them, like Janis Ian and even Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, you
and
can
it's
do
still
that.
Just Joni Mitchell out there. That was my wonder.
Well, yeah, in a way it kind of has been sort of that, because I get to be the one who chooses which songs we do. I do have the boss role. I mean, I get to be the kind of the chooser, and everybody lets me, and they don't seem to mind too much. So, you know, in a way, I kind of have the luxury of both, but I played solo here and there and found it rather lonely.
Yeah, I can understand that, especially when one goes on the road.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard nightmares.
Some of the loneliest.
It's especially hard for women, I think.
some of the lowest points of my life were solo road tours.
Now, some of your songs have been featured on TV shows. How did that happen?
Yeah.
Alias and
mm-hmm.
How did you get that going?
There's a music placement. Well, we've had a couple of different circumstances evolve which happened, but you know, we've been doing this kind of a long time, and so I think during the Atlantic years there was a whole machine in place for us that looked for placements. And currently the label has employed a guy whose job it is to look for placements for music on the label. Also, here and there you just make friends over the years, and so here and there I've made friends who are people who are in the business and who just kind of, they have a few CDs in their pocket looking for the right opportunity, and here and there they come up with one. I did study film when I was younger, and I think that here and there I've found over the years people who are photographers and who are filmmakers tend to like our music. Billy's My Music and St. Louis stuff, and that kind of helps too.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mary Lorson. She's a singer, songwriter, and musician. I wanted to ask you this, too. Have you ever been commissioned to write a song for a TV show? Would you do that? It seems to me they're extracting stuff you've already written, but would you ever want to write,
be commissioned? Oh, we've done that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, Billy and I started doing original scores for films a few years back, and as a matter of fact, on April 6th, we're going to play live the score for an HBO documentary we did called What Remains, and that's on the photographer Sally Mann. And the director was a guy named Stephen Cantor, who's done a number of films, and he was a fan of Matt Rose when he was in college, and he hired us to do that score. We've done some shorter scores as well. We love doing that kind of work together. So that's really liberating and fun.
And so how was that different, collaborating and just doing instrumental stuff?
Well, you don't have to get to the chorus, you know, by 1:10. But the really good thing, too, is you work with filmmakers, which is really challenging, and I'm not saying that. I say that, you know, in the euphemistic way and also in the literal way. People talk about music in very different ways. So sometimes they're really good at telling you what they like, but they're not really good at telling you what they want because it's kind of impossible. They don't know because they've heard it. So it's a real learning experience, and we had some really interesting learning experiences on the Sally Mann movie.
So you basically don't have any power, though, right? Is that what it comes down to?
Yeah.
Unless you become somebody like Philip Glass or...
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
So you have to do what they want and...
Well, they give you suggestions, and then you come up with pieces that respond to their suggestions, and then they tell you which ones they like and would like you to develop, and then you go back and you develop them. Sometimes you can get pretty far with a piece before they actually change their mind, and that actually happens quite often. The other thing that happens quite often is that while they're putting together their mock-up or their rough edit, the editors will pull pieces of music that they adore to edit to. And then they're saying, wait, we can't afford R.E.M., so can you do something that's kind of like Fall on Me, but don't rip it off? And you're thinking, that's a really special song. There's no way I'm going to, you know what I mean? And then you think, well, I could pull from my own back catalog of songs that I actually just wrote genuinely out of a moment of wanting to write, but then you can't do that because they're on other records or something. Sometimes we collect the parts cars and the songs that haven't gotten recorded, and in case the moment comes when they want something that is special and genuine, not written to order, and that has worked too, actually. On the Sally Mann movie, one of those was a piece of mine that just hadn't gotten made yet and came from its own moment.
And do you get a chance to see the film while you're developing this music, or it's just them saying this is what we want and we're going to plant it here, and then you get to see it afterwards?
They give us sections. On this one, they've given us sections. I understand. I mean, I think it's different on every film. On this one, they did give us some sections of footage and said, like, there's one piece we love called the chicken piece, and the photographer is out in her barnyard with her son, and the chickens are running around, and it's like this lighthearted moment, and the mother is admonishing her son to be gentle with the chicken as he picks it up. And so we had really fun, like, writing that, and we were able to check out the rhythm of the way they were walking around the yard, and the piece kind of works with that. And then other times they just say, the other times they'll just tell you, we want something somber and a little bit spooky, or... You know, this is a little sad. She's talking about her husband's illness, and, you know.
Well, what an interesting education, I would think.
It's a neat job. It was really, really, I'd love to do that all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I want to play another excerpt from Realistic. This one's called Serenade.
Play me like the cheap guitar I am, and then stray me. Leave me on some foreign bench and then replace me. You see, we're really all the same with different faces. I guess some dignity remains in
in the morning.
Tell us about that. Tell us about that piece.
That piece, I find over the years when, after making a record, there's this period of time where, you know, I kind of write in batches, and I do think of records when I write. And so I try to think which ones will go together in a collection of 8 or 12 or whatever. And so after making the second one, Tricks for Dawn, I didn't know what I wanted to do next. I didn't know what my goal was. I didn't know what realistic was going to be yet. And so I tend to write these palate cleanser songs, and I like that because it's before I've set a goal.
Well, what do you call them?
A palate cleanser.
Oh,
I just
okay.
think it that way. I think, like, let's write some palate cleanser songs. There's no goal. I'm not trying to impress anybody. I'm not giving these the ban yet. It's just what comes out. And that one came out. And then I did find myself working very hard on the lyrics for that one and deciding what I meant. Sometimes the lyrics are a little quicker than others. This one was not. And I think that I was trying to articulate the incredible disappointment and bewilderment of what happened in 2000 in our country. Politically, I mean, the coup of 2000 is still stunning to me and everybody else, right?
Yep.
We just cannot believe it happened, and we don't fully understand still how it happened and who
got. We don't know how we can prevent it.
Yeah, and how we're going to correct it and get out of it. And it's just, it's. I mean, worse now. But back then, the wound and the shock were fresh. And so I think that's what I was writing about. And I was one of the absentee ballot people in 2000 election. I was on the road, and I was in England, in Europe. So the news is trickling into us, and the American election hasn't actually been decided. And we're waiting. We couldn't believe what was going on. And so it was hard to walk around other countries and have any dignity when it had been hard enough already. But it was particularly hard after that to make any sense of what you're supposed to believe in this country. And so I think that's what I was trying to reflect.
Uh-huh. And so are you affected a lot by politics? Will we be seeing a lot more political songs from Mary Lorson in the future?
Well, when they come out that way, I write them, but I tend not to try to do it deliberately. I mean, I love when stuff like that really feels genuine, but I don't ever want to be seen as being on a soapbox or pushing ideas down anyone's throat. So I try to walk, I intend to walk that line as as fairly as possible. Mm-hmm. Plus, I just think that as an artist, you never want to box yourself in.
Well, I actually get angry at people who say artists should shut up. I mean, when do you put your citizenship, you know, in the closet when you become a creative person?
Definitely.
I find that so absurd.
Yeah.
When they tell people to shut up about their politics, it makes no sense to me. It's so un-American.
No, it isn't. It's so uncreative. I mean, the idea of art is to discover and to express and explore mm-hmm. and to stretch. Whatever it is you're trying to try to learn by stretching your horizons and expand your abilities and your ways of thinking. So that's why I think I would never just call myself a political artist. But I do think, yeah, I'm a pretty political person. I mean, if you met my mom,
really,
yeah, there's no way, you know. I mean, we're chatty lefty people, and that's just who we are. Uh-huh. And we want things to be better and fairer.
And don't we all? Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, according to your website, it said that you were writing a comedy about breast cancer. Is that still happening?
I was trying to write a comedy about breast cancer because I was so sick of how morbid it was. And there are a lot of absurdities which, once you get past the idea of something being life-threatening, really do make you laugh. I mean, I had some scenes in mind regarding plastic surgery because, like, you know, how can I put this delicately? Well, you know, part of the title of my last album, Realistic, came from the fact that when you have a prosthetic appendage put on and they call it realistic, the first thing you know is that it ain't real. And it certainly doesn't look real. It certainly doesn't feel real. And so I wanted to kind of bring in, you know, there's this male plastic surgeon. I sat there with my best friend, a girl, and we were sitting there and he was handing us this whole bill of business about these realistic prosthetics. And it was just ridiculously, you know.
A comedy of errors, perhaps?
Kind of a comedy. But I have set that aside, actually. Mm-hmm. I've written a couple screenplays over the years, and I've never endeavored to try to get involved in the film world, but I do just kind of like to put those things together, and so I collect ideas, and at some point I might finish the one that I'm working on now. Mm-hmm. But and it does have some breast cancer in it, but it's not a black comedy. Although I would like someone to write a black comedy about it. It just might not end up being me. The second time around kind of kicked me in the butt.
Oh, I'll bet. I'll bet.
You know.
Now, I understand you also teach English.
I do.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about teaching. That's so different. Do your students get embarrassed when they see their teacher on the stage?
They haven't seen me on stage, but thanks to the wonders of the internet, they've all Googled me. And so, you know, I don't know whether that's an advantage or a disadvantage. I think in the short term it has advantages. In the long term, I'm not sure. But I love the kids, and I love language, I love talking, I love writing, and I love young people. And so mm-hmm. I'm learning a lot about teaching. This is my second year.
Oh.
It's incredibly hard work. To do it well, to serve everybody individually well, it's a huge amount of work. And it's hard to do it without sacrificing yourself, including your health. So I'm determined not to do that. But that said, I feel really, really lucky to mm-hmm. have the job I have.
Uh-huh.
And know the kids I know.
And what exactly do you teach? Creative writing, too?
Yep.
It includes creative writing, I would assume.
Yep.
Yeah.
I teach English literature and composition, and so we do write, and we read, and we read plays. We watch films here and there. We do a lot of writing. I think the kids would like to do more creative writing, so you're reminding me that the rest of this semester I should have them do more of that.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of creative writing. I think it's a way for people to express their souls, you know?
Definitely.
Instead of academic writing or, you know, the rote stuff that you're taught to have to do over and over again. Yeah.
It's hard to walk the line because you get that argument from the kids a lot, and there's so much validity to it. You know, there is a very stiff way of writing academically, and yet I want these kids to go to college. And I want them to get in, and I want them to be taken seriously. So mm-hmm. I keep telling them, master the conventions and then subvert them. You know, you're in 10th grade.
Great.
You know, you can master them and then be better than them, you know.
Mm-hmm. So. We only have about a minute left. What's coming up for Mary Lorson and St. Lowe? Are you guys going to do any gigs this summer?
We're going to do some gigs, but more importantly, I really want to mention that Billy Cote and Kathy Ziegler and I, and Kathy is the keyboard player in Dawn of the Buffalo and a wonderful solo artist in her own right. The three of us have collaborated on a project we call Piano Creeps, and we're almost done with an album, and it's mostly those guys' record. They've written most of the songs, and they've done most of the production, and I'm just the singer, and they've done an amazing job, and so we're just about finished with it. I'm really excited about mm-hmm. it, so I'm looking forward to it.
Anybody be able to see you live this summer?
Yes. Maxie's, hopefully Grassroots. That's about it. And April 6th. I'm not sure when this airs, but April 6th we'll be playing at Cornell Cinema.
That's great.
And May 20th at Felicia's Atomic Lounge.
Well, Mary Lorson, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.